This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Among the most anticipated and most enthusiastically reviewed novels of the year is Don DeLillo's new book, Underworld. DeLillo has been called the chief shaman of the paranoid school of American fiction. That's perhaps best exemplified by his novel Libra, a fictionalized version of Lee Harvey Oswald's life. The new novel, Underworld, begins on a day in 1951 framed by two events, the Giants winning the pennant with a surprise home run, and the Soviets testing the atom bomb. In a New Yorker article about DeLillo, David Remnick wrote, "Many of DeLillo's old themes are in Underworld, the increasing power of the image and the media in the modern world, the uncertainty of American life after the Kennedy assassination, a sense of national danger, men and women who live outside the mainstream of ordinary life and language. But more often, Underworld is a darkly funny satire of post-war language, manner, and obsessions." I asked DeLillo why he chose the baseball game and atom bomb test to frame his new novel. He told me he was checking out the baseball game in an edition of the New York Times from October 4th, 1951, and he found the story of the bomb test.
It struck me with the force of revelation. On the front page of the Times, there was a headline on the left about this legendary, what is now a legendary ball game, Giants capture pennant and so on. And on the right side of the front page, symmetrically matched three columns, a three-line headline, the same typeface, Soviets explode atomic bomb. Something about the juxtaposition of these two events made me think there was something here I wanted to explore. I wasn't sure at the moment quite what. What I did feel was a sense of the power of history. And through the 5 years it took me to write the book, it began to occur to me slowly that, in fact, there is a kind of relationship between this ball game, this particular ball game, and that atomic test on the other side of the world.
And what do you think the relationship is?
Well, I think that the ball game was a unifying and largely joyous event, the kind of event in which people come out of their houses in order to share their feelings with others, and an event not primarily defined by television. There was only limited coverage. With the onset of the bomb, the communal spirit becomes associated with danger and loss rather than with celebration. And the sense of catastrophic events framed and defined by TV grows ever stronger. Assassinations, terrorist acts, even natural disasters. In my private little history text, this ball game marks a kind of transitional moment between the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War.
You've said that murders actually draw us together. You know, you're talking about the crowd either being a crowd expressing its joy or coming together because of catastrophe. You've said murders draw us together. They draw people together in ways that only the most disastrous contemporary events can match. We depend on disaster to consolidate our vision. And there's a murder that is captured on videotape and is shown over and over and over again on television in your new book. And it's a murder by the Texas Highway Killer, who's a sniper who shoots at motorists driving by. And this is accidentally captured on tape by a girl with a video camera. I'd like you to do a reading from a passage about this. This is from your new book, Underworld. Feel free to introduce it for us before you read.
The videotape is a curious contemporary phenomenon, and it is marked in a way by repetition. Such tapes always seem to be characterized by violence or tragedy, and I've begun to get the idea that this endless repetition, the re-showing day after day of a particular tape, until its power dwindles and another tape replaces it. I begin to think that this is almost our last perception of nature. That is, the violence we see on these tapes is not choreographed movie violence. It is violence in its natural state, caught in some cases accidentally, casually. And so it has a kind of base reality. It is real, it is taped, and it is shown repeatedly.
Maybe you could do the reading now.
It shows something awful and unaccompanied. You want your wife to see it because it is real this time, not fancy movie violence. The realness beneath the layers of cosmetic perception. Hurry up, Janet. Here it comes. He dies so fast. There is no accompaniment of any kind. It is very stripped. You want to tell her it is realer than real, but then she will ask what that means. The way the camera reacts to the gunshot, a startled reaction that brings pity and terror into the frame, the girl's own shock, the girl's identification with the victim. You don't see the blood, which is probably trickling behind his ear and down the back of his neck. The way his head is twisted away from the door, the twist of the head gives you only a partial profile, and it's the wrong side. It's not the side where he was hit. And maybe you're being a little aggressive here, practically forcing your wife to watch. Why? What are you telling her? Are you making a little statement, like I'm going to ruin your day out of ordinary spite? Or a big statement, like this is the risk of existing? Either way, you're rubbing her face in this tape, and you don't know why. It shows the car drifting toward the guardrail. And then there's a jostling sense of two other lanes and part of another car, a split-second blur, and the tape ends here, either because the girl stopped shooting or because some central authority, the police or the district attorney or the TV station, decided there was nothing else you had to see. This is either the 10th or 11th homicide committed by the Texas highway killer. The number is uncertain because the police believe that one of the shootings may have been a copycat crime. And there is something about videotape, isn't there? And this particular kind of serial crime. This is a crime designed for random taping and immediate playing. You sit there and wonder if this kind of crime became more possible when the means of taping an event and playing it immediately, without a neutral interval, a balancing space and time, became widely available. Taping and playing intensifies and compresses the event. It dangles a need to do it again. You sit there thinking that the serial murder has found its medium, or vice versa. An act of shadow technology, of compressed time and repeated images, stark and glary and unremarkable.
That's Don DeLillo reading from his new novel, Underworld. I think it's a kind of interesting coincidence that this comes out right after the death of Princess Diana in the auto accident, when America just watched over and over and over again the same video footage of the totaled car in the tunnel. And that seemed to like hold everybody together, watching it over and over again.
I'd rather not say too much about that particular tragedy, because just about everything has been said, but it is curious that it was an event not just overproduced and over-orchestrated by the subsequent media coverage, but an event, as some people think, partly caused by the media. And in a terrible and grotesque way, this makes it perfect for our time.
You know, the idea of watching a murder captured accidentally on tape over and over again reminds me, of course, of the Zapruder film and of the real-life TV murder of Oswald by Ruby. I mean, did you see that as it happened?
I did not see it as it happened, no. I found out about it later in the day, and I suppose that particular moment, happening only 2 days after President Kennedy himself was killed, marks a very curious transition. You know, Kennedy was killed on film. His death was a home movie. Oswald was killed on television, as if to mark the social difference between these two men. The Zapruder film became a very exclusive entity. You could not see the Zapruder film unless you were willing to pay a great deal of money to see it. It was not shown publicly in this country until the mid-1970s, whereas Oswald, on videotape, was shown repeatedly for years and years.
Did you see violence? I should mention, as our listeners know, that your earlier novel, one of your earlier novels, Libra, was about Oswald and a fictionalized version of Oswald, the Kennedy assassination, and the people investigating it. Do you see violent news as replacing theater in the American mind?
It seems to be replacing a number of things. The impact of the news seems far greater now than it used to be, and it's not necessarily substantial news. We seem to pay less and less attention to substantial news and to devote a greater amount of our energies to news that seems to have a kind of tabloid emptiness at its heart. And in a curious and very, very subjective way, I associate this with something that seems to be happening as a result of the end of the Cold War. That is that events used to be calibrated to the phenomenon of awesome Cold War conflict, even events that had no connection to the U.S. or the USSR. This curious measurability has disappeared with the end of the Cold War, and it's left a kind of vacuum in which news itself, regardless of its substance, becomes an important element in our lives.
I think it, you know, in a way, it gives us something to talk about. You know, like whether we're talking about the baseball game or the latest murder, it's something we have in common with strangers that we could talk about.
Well, I suppose that's true. There is a sense in which the darker the news is, the more important it seems to be to people. It's almost as though the narrative of our time is transmitted in the form of dangerous and sometimes catastrophic news. This is the narrative that perhaps has replaced the novel in a curious sense.
Don DeLillo is my guest. His new novel is called Underworld. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Don DeLillo, his new novel is called Underworld. You've said that the thread running through your books is living in dangerous times, and no one seems to be able to write about your themes without using the word paranoia. What do you think those are your themes?
In Libra, there was clearly a sense of conspiracy that informed the book, and it was a conspiracy that tended to be perpetrated by a small number of individuals plotting in the shadows of our society. In this book, in Underworld, there is a different kind of distrust and suspicion. It does not seem to arise from individual plots so much as from the overarching technology that informs our lives. From the vast number of systems connections that take place beyond our comprehension, I think this makes us more prone to half-belief. We tend to half-believe everything and to maintain conviction in nothing. I think there is a direct connection in this decade between technology and paranoia. And it's interesting that there is such a paranoid presence on the internet, which is the ultimate source of our individual concerns with technology.
Do you spend a lot of time looking on the internet?
No, I've spent just a little time on the internet.
You know, what you're talking about, the connection between technology and paranoia, I think comes together in a character who's a waste management specialist, and part of what he specializes in is toxic waste. So he has to find ways of getting rid of very dangerous things.
This is one of the underworlds, I suppose, that the title refers to. The very substantial and dangerous underworld of toxic waste. For many years, people talked about the weapons of the Cold War. We devised beautiful and resonant names out of mythology for these weapons. The weapons themselves were beautiful. The explosions they produced were awesome and almost godly. At the same time, no one said much about the waste that these weapons were producing. Now this waste is being buried in the ground. And it's an interesting coincidence that the word plutonium derives from the name Pluto, Pluto the god of the underworld, which is another reason why the novel bears the name it bears.
My guest is Don DeLillo, and Underworld is the name of his new novel. The first phrase in your new novel is, he speaks in your voice, American. What is American to you?
When my books were first translated into French, I was delighted to find that on the first page of the French edition, the statement that this book was translated from the American, not from the English, from the American. And I think the language I use, particularly in this novel, is the American language. Very hard to translate, in fact. And steeped in American rhythms, slang, all those special languages ranging from baseball to the slick locutions of advertising to the Italian-American slang of the Bronx. That's the language I'm referring to when I say American. And the people I'm referring to are people of diverse backgrounds, beginning with the immigrants of the early part of this century and their children.
You've had to go back to some of the nouns of the 50s, you know, certain products and styles and ad slogans, foods that we don't eat anymore. Were there words that you rediscovered in writing Underworld that you found to be particularly evocative of the period?
One of the pleasures of this book was rediscovering the language of the 1940s and 1950s. I'm not sure I can cite particular words, but when I tried to reconstruct the street argot of my own background in the Bronx, one of the curious pleasures of this endeavor was figuring out spellings for such strange words, words that in many cases I don't think ever found a life outside those narrow neighborhoods.
Such as?
Well, there's a curious word, brouch, which I've never heard spoken anywhere outside the Italian Bronx. And the word means to welsh on a debt, essentially. If you say to me, you owe me $20, DeLillo, I say to you, it's a brouch. This means you're not getting it. Where does this word come from? Well, I think it comes from an Italian word that means to burn. In other words, I am burning you for this money. But I've never heard it since I was 17 years old.
You know, you've talked about the Cold War bringing a certain climate of fear and uncertainty, but you grew up in, you were born in the late 30s, so some of your formative years were during World War II. So really early on in your life, you were exposed to fear and uncertainty. Do you think you were shaped at all, that your sensibility was shaped at all by the war, which you must have heard something about? It wasn't being fought in your neighborhood, obviously, or even in your country, but still, it was on the radio. You might have had family who were fighting.
I think I was too young, in fact, to have been deeply influenced by it. I think the Cold War had a deeper effect. And I think there were two levels of danger that we experienced in those years. Obviously, the possibility of a nuclear exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union. But there was also a psychological sense that flowed from the assassinations and social disruptions of the 1960s. And even though I was older then, I think these things shaped my work, surely, more than anything I experienced when I was 8 or 9 or 10.
Don DeLillo, his new novel is called Underworld. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Don DeLillo. His new novel, Underworld, is a dark satire about American pop culture and paranoia during the Cold War. I believe both your parents were Italian immigrants, and I'm wondering if they spoke Italian a lot in the house, and if you were, as a boy, exposed to two languages at the same time, English and Italian.
I was exposed to two languages, but we were brought up as American kids, and I spent my younger life, playing in the streets, every sort of street game ever devised. The last thing kids my age in those days wanted to do was to appear to be European. And to my regret, I would say that I did not master Italian as a youngster and speak only a kind of sporadic Italian now.
Do you think that hearing a lot of Italian in the house and in the neighborhood affected your ear for language in any way, even though it was something you wanted to really avoid at the time? Maybe it was even an embarrassment to you at the time.
Well, the language in my work, which is the only language that matters to me, really, is so deeply woven in consciousness that I'm not sure I can understand how it began to manifest itself. I do know that I have a curious relationship to the page. I use an old manual typewriter, largely because of the sensuous sensation of hitting the keys and watching and hearing the hammers strike the page. And I have a kind of audio-visual connection to language. That is, I'm not only aware of the rhythms of my sentences, which is something I think that characterizes my work, but I'm also conscious of the physical appearance of those alphabetic units that compose a given word. There is a relationship between certain letters that strikes me in a rather important way. And it was only recently that I was reading the afterword to a translation of the Odyssey, in which the translator Robert Fitzgerald mentions, in connection with Greek letters, the cut or sculpture of these letters, which is exactly what I respond to while I'm writing. It's a process that seems to happen automatically.
Visually, you're talking about?
Visually, yes, absolutely. Certain words will arrange themselves based in large part on the connection, the shape of the letters in those words. I might connect a word like dull with a word like lurid, which has an L, which has a D, which has a U, largely because of the visual relationship the two words have. This happens not through painstaking writing and rewriting. It tends to happen automatically.
Do you also read the sentences out loud as you're writing to see how the rhythms sound?
No, I don't. I hear it. And I hear it as it happens and rarely have to revise a sentence on the basis of rhythm alone. These things seem to arrange themselves.
The point of view in your novel shifts several times. And often, you're sometimes writing in the second person, in the you.
Yes.
That strikes me as a very difficult form to pull off, to keep up with. And I'm wondering why you chose to write in the you, in the second person, when you did, and what it means to write that way, you know, what the difficulty is.
I think it all derives from the first sentence of the book. He speaks in your voice. I decided that periodically I would return to that second person singular. Sometimes, in fact, it becomes second person plural. And I think it was a way of continuing the theme that is announced in the first sentence, that there is a connection between us, those of us who are Americans, despite our very different origins, our very different orientations. The you is a unifying you. And I think one of the things early in the book that connects people is the voice of the baseball announcer, Russ Hodges, a voice heard, of course, beyond the borders of the stadium where the game is being played, heard by people on the stock exchange and by people in kitchens and by people in bars. And this is the first connective thread in a book that eventually connects many things.
Don DeLillo is my guest. His new novel is called Underworld. Your new novel is filled with, you know, important themes about crowds and individuals, about consumerism and danger and murder and the Cold War and the importance of baseball in the lives of Americans. And you're doing this at a time when a lot of fiction and a lot of memoirs have really focused on personal relationships, on the family, on a much smaller, more circumscribed and intimate world. And I'm wondering if you feel that you're intentionally doing that. You know, that you're intentionally looking for bigger themes at a time when a lot of fiction is focusing on something very personal.
Fiction will always explore those small and semi-concealed corners of experience, and it should, and it will. But my own fiction tends to be drawn to the wider culture. I think a writer, I think any artist is finally helpless against the tendency of his own perceptions. Basically, I do what I'm driven to do. It's not the construction of a personal philosophy. I do absorb things around me. And I do tend to move toward larger themes, things that could not have been written by writers working 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, because these things did not exist in the world in the way in which they do now.
You have tried to remain a private person in the face of your success as a writer. And I'm wondering if you think that the same instinct that makes you want to, you know, avoid a lot of personal publicity and personal exposure has to do with the instinct that keeps you writing fiction about larger themes as opposed to a more autobiographical fiction. A lot of fiction is kind of veiled autobiography. Yours isn't, or doesn't seem to me to be.
No, it certainly isn't. I think this is a society that absorbs everything in the name of consumer consciousness. And I think the writer has to try to stay unabsorbed. He has to try to avoid becoming a kind of universal elevator music. He has to maintain a certain tacit opposition to the corporation, the state, the whole process of consumer consciousness, of white-hot consumption and instantaneous waste. He has to stand apart, in other words.
You're very interested in the subject of celebrity and what it means in America. You wrote about that a lot in your novel, Mao, too. And you also write about that in Underworld, in the opening scene at that baseball game where the Giants win the pennant. You know, Frank Sinatra and Jackie Gleason are in the stands. And you write, the crowd uses Sinatra for a reference for everything that happens. Somebody makes a nice play, they look at Frank to see how he reacts. The beer vendor trips on a step, they look at Frank to see if he has noticed. Why do you think celebrities become reference points like that?
Someone in the book says that celebrities are the master spirits of the age. It's hard to say what it is that makes certain people more famous. Surely there's a personal magnetism that's an important part of it. And in these days, the press of public events has become greater than it was before. And there's a kind of hunger for transcendence. And it is first and foremost the famous person, the celebrity, even the empty celebrity, who satisfies this urge. Celebrities take us out of ordinary life and into a kind of specious higher state.
Don DeLillo, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Don DeLillo's new novel is called Underworld.